This show furnished by Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervey's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervey. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervey and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world right here on KBC.com. You are listening to Gervey's Law. I am Alan Gervey. I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. This is where we intersect law and life. And a lot of folks listen at KBC.com. In fact, people come up to me all the time and say, Alan, how can I hear Gervey's Law? I hear you have some great guests on your show, and I may be just a little outside of the 790 talk radio area, and I need to hear it wherever I am on Saturday afternoon. So I always tell them KBC.com, listen live. And if you want to see and hear about podcasts from the past, you go to rgwlawfirm.com. That's rgwlawfirm.com. Or go to kbc.com and you can hear Gervey's Laws. Gervey's Laws. That's it. All the laws that are fit to hear right here on kbc.com. So today we have a very interesting show. But before we get to the show, I do want to tell you a little bit about something that I've been experiencing over the last couple years. So when I was a kid, I used to love the game hide and go seek. What kid doesn't like it? You hide and you have someone come and find you. And then all these years passed and I forgot how much fun it was until all of a sudden my 3-year-old son Hudson and my 2-year-old daughter Harper said to their daddy, we want to play hide and go seek. And I'm thinking, how do they even know about hide and go seek? I haven't even talked about it. I haven't even told them my experiences growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, hiding all over the neighborhood with all my friends trying to find me and doing the opposite, trying to find them. So we played a game of hide and go seek. It was a couple of months ago, and now all of a sudden it's their favorite game. And I tell you, I cannot find them. They hide all over the house. They have the greatest spots to hide. They're so quiet. Sometimes they even go in disguise so they think that I can't recognize them. The other day I found my son Hudson wearing a mask and hiding, and he didn't think I would recognize him. But I did. I knew it was my son. I knew it wasn't someone else. And little old Harper, she puts herself in places that you cannot find her. I don't know how she does it. And sometimes I get a little nervous because I can't find her. I'll tell you something, though. Today we're going to talk about real life hide and seek. Real life hide and seek. Fugitives. Finding Fugitives. There's a show that I'm sure everyone has seen called America's Most Wanted. It debuted many years ago with John Walsh as the host, and it was just fascinating. Fascinating to go and into the world of the FBI and go into the world of people searching for really bad people. And again, I have to give you a caveat here. My kids are not really bad. And yes, they're hiding, but they're having fun. But some of these characters, the FBI's top 10, they are some bad dudes. And I got to tell you, it's really exciting today to talk about how the good guys go after the bad guys. Later on in the show, we are going to have Scott Gariola on the show. Scott is an FBI special agent. He's a member of an LA area fugitive task force, and he actually apprehended Whitey Bulger. Whitey Bulger, of course, is the Boston crime boss who was on the run for many years, and he was found right here in Santa Monica. And I'll tell you, he was featured on America's Most Wanted 23 times before he was finally handcuffed. So we're going to talk to Scott about that and about seeking out, finding all these other bad people, these criminals who are on the run. But first, before we get to Scott, I am really honored to talk to someone who actually created America's Most Wanted. He is the executive producer, and he is an investigative reporter, broadcast journalism, producer. He's got a long list of accomplishments, and he's done so much good for this world by bringing America's Most Wanted to the airways. Michael Linder, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you, Alan. That was very kind of you to say. And vis-a-vis your intro, yes, you could run, but you cannot hide.
There you go. You can run, but you can't hide. You know, Michael, it's just so intriguing. You look at everything that you've done over the past 20, 25 years, and we have to ask you first, what's it like being an investigative reporter? Because so many people dream about doing things that others just can't do. And you got involved with this a long time ago. Obviously, it spurred you on to America's Most Wanted. But how did you get into it? And what's it like being this kind of sleuth, but reporting to the world?
I think it's kind of an unlicensed version of what lawyers do, Alan. It's a matter of digging into a case, whether it's a story, you know, some outrage, some environmental disaster, you name it, and just learning to or having an affinity to digging into the nuts and bolts and uncovering things that may not be able to be Googled and, you know, but are out there.
How did you develop skills in this, Michael? There were no Google. There was no Google. What did you do? You were searching in your neighborhood and said, wow, I'm really good at uncovering facts and truths.
It really began when I was 16 and started at that proverbial local 500-watt daytime farm station. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the day's newscast was who was born, who died, and who had a kid in the county, and what the kids were having for lunch tomorrow so you didn't make the same thing for dinner. So, you know, it just kind of grew and got deeper and deeper. And I started, you know, digging into a few things when in New York, pollution in the Hudson River. It just opened my eyes. So I came at it in an evolutionary pattern.
One thing led to another, isn't that right?
Yeah. Though today there are some incredible schools of journalism that offer investigative courses. And really, that's the fast track if you want the straight scoop.
Yeah, well, that's the modern world. Everyone has a course for everything nowadays. But I'll tell you, some of us, like you and me, we go back a few years. And, you know, I know when I got into law, I just walked into NBC and I said, I want to work here. And they said, we don't have a job for you. I said, I don't care about a job. I just want to work here. And I convinced them to work here, work there. And then, of course, went to law school after that. But, you know, for those of us who started way back when, you never thought that you would accomplish the things that you have. And I know I didn't think that I would. But is it true that you actually shook hands with Saddam Hussein?
I did, and tried to talk him out of Kuwait on the eve of the Persian Gulf War while executive producer and creator of The Jesse Jackson Show. And as troops were massing in Saudi Arabia, we got in with a great deal of difficulty to Baghdad, had two meetings with Saddam Hussein. I asked him if we could go into occupied Kuwait, where journalists had not been allowed. He said yes, gave us a jet, and flew us into, essentially at that moment in time, the heart of darkness.
Wow.
We brought back 200-some hostages that had been trapped in occupied Kuwait.
How did you do that, Michael? How were you able to get the hostages released? Is it just because you were talking sports with Hussein, or what how did you get to do this?
It was actually Saddam Hussein's brainstorm, because he wanted to demonstrate to the American people that he had no ill will to the United States, that his problem was with the Bush administration, which he claimed had essentially double-crossed him. you know, a charge that wasn't without merit. Essentially, his belief was that the United States gave a wink and a nod when he informed the country that he was going to go into Kuwait, which had actually been separated from Iraq back in Lawrence of Arabia days.
Right.
And, you know, he considered a setup job. So his problem was with the Bushes, and he was going to show that he was a humanitarian
and he liked
wanted
you.
To get these people safe and sound home.
And what about, was Jesse Jackson with you at the time?
Yeah, it was his show. And Jackson, of course, had been in the Middle East acting on behalf of captured Americans. And this was, essentially, it was going to be episode one of his weekly syndicated TV series until Time Warner, who produced it, found out about it. I got a phone call from the chairman of Time Warner saying, "You're not going there. We've got too many contracts with Washington, and, you know, I'm not going to jeopardize those."
Yeah,
so
we know. We
I
know.
Found myself with an interview with Saddam Hussein and had to go find a buyer for it.
That's crazy. You know, and we know Time Warner, when they have their contracts, they have their contracts. They're not going to let anyone see the Dodgers games if they have a contract. So I want to ask you before we take a quick break about America's Most Wanted. How did that all start?
You know, there's a long history of that actually began in Los Angeles in the early 1950s when TV was only on the air for a couple of hours a day. And KTLA used part of those unused hours to display wanted posters for the FBI's 10 Most Wanted, which had just begun in 1950. And 41 years later, I was living in Tokyo, came to Fox's attention. They asked me to come in and sit down and talk about possible shows that we could do. And after kicking around a bunch of ideas, we landed on the notion of essentially beginning with a catchphrase: watch television, catch criminals. And I spent the summer of 87 running around America with a cameraman, a sound man, and a college kid intern reenacting, doing the first television reenactments of crimes,
and
all shot guerrilla style, not telling anybody we were going to do it. So we were abducting people in midnight in Indianapolis, burning down farmhouses, you name it.
Just like the show on Fox at the time, I guess, was Cops, which they were doing things apparently guerrilla style as well. But then, of course, you got John Walsh involved. So we're going to talk about how he got involved and how people started to relate to his story and how the show took off. We're going to get to that after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law. We're talking to Michael Linder. I'm Alan Gervie. We'll be right back.
Hiring people is probably the worst part of my job. It's such a hassle, the searching, the sorting through resumes. Most people don't have the right experience.
We started using ZipRecruiter about 3 months ago. Right from the start, you could tell it was going to make hiring a lot easier. One click and my job was posted to 100+ job boards, all the top sites.
All of the candidates came to my dashboard, and it's easy to compare them. Thumbs up if I liked them, thumbs down if I didn't. No emails and attachments, printing up docs, phone calls, none of that.
And I couldn't believe the number of great applicants we got. I had the person we needed within 1 week. I don't know how we hired before ZipRecruiter.
Whether you're looking to fill one position or 20, find the best candidates with ZipRecruiter, where your job is just one click away from 100+ job sites. ZipRecruiter, the fastest way to hire. And right now you can try ZipRecruiter free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio. That's ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio. ZipRecruiter.com/talkradio.
Why do 8 out of 10 drivers prefer Lyft over the competition? Could be that you earn up to $1,500 a week driving your own car during hours you choose. Give enough rides each week and you can keep up to 95% commission. That's right, 95%. Better yet, we'll start you off with a $500 bonus. That's right, $500 for each new Lyft driver in Los Angeles. And you'll only earn more from there. Whether you're putting money toward a mortgage, saving for vacation, or just looking for a better way to earn, choose Lyft. Apply at lalyft.com. That's lalyft.com today. While you jot that down, here's another fun fact. Lyft is the only app that allows tipping, and 60% of our rides tip the driver. Because at Lyft, drivers come first. Be your own boss, pick your own schedule, and get paid weekly. Experience the difference of Lyft and pocket that $500 bonus by applying at lalyft.com. KYFT.com today. Terms apply.
Your source for breaking news. Live and local. KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we are turning Talk Radio upside down. I'm feeling upside down. We're going to get into some real scary stuff now. If you were listening to the first segment, you know we are talking about finding fugitives. This is a legal show that is today crossing over with police work and FBI work. And we're privileged to have with us Michael Linder. Michael Linder is the creator and executive producer for America's Most Wanted, one of the most successful television shows in our time. And before the break, Michael, you were telling us the genesis of America's Most Wanted, dating back probably 40 years before it really got going. And then it took off. You were running around recreating crime scenes. How did John Walsh get involved, and how did you take it on its course that became such a well-known way of looking for criminals?
Well, I'd finished the pilot, but there was this nagging issue of who the host was going to be, and we interviewed a lot of people. Barry Diller, who was chairman of Fox at the time, said he did not want an actor. In fact, he insisted that we do the show out of Washington, D.C., to be close to federal law enforcement, but also to be away and not be infected by slick Hollywood production values.
Right.
So we interviewed everybody from Teresa Saldana, who was a victim of violence on New York subways, P.X. Kelly, who'd been commandant of the Marine Corps, a number of victims, advocates. None of them seemed to quite have that indefinable thing. I flew down to Boca Raton and met with John Walsh, who, of course, we'd known from kids' pictures on milk cartons. And when I first walked in and saw the guy and saw his presence and saw the kind of intensity and dedication and doggedness when it came to doing something on behalf of America's abused children, it just became obvious on the spot that this was our guy.
So Michael, you selected him yourself without conferring with anyone?
Well, with Fox officials in Washington, they knew I was going down there. He was another of people we had interviewed, maybe 20, 25 potential hosts.
That's as many as I interviewed for my co-host. And we got Carrie Kasem, who's not here today, so... Anyway,
We
both got lucky. So let me ask you, how long was it after John's son, Adam, had been abducted that he took on this gig?
Yeah, it had been something of a... Well, 1981 was when Adam Walsh was abducted, and then, gosh, sadly, later found beheaded. And so it had been 7 years, and John had been working legislative angles, trying to make sure that the FBI, for example, could be involved in cases involving kidnapped kids without them having to cross state lines, really doing something as a victim's advocate in trying to change the law. It was still quite fresh in his mind. Adam had a brother and a sister who were being raised by John and his wife at the time, Reveille. And here was a crusader who was speaking to anybody he could, any legislator he could, trying to do something for America's abused kids.
And how did you start working with FBI, police officers, law enforcement? How did that all go down, and was John a natural in that kind of relationship?
The relationship actually began before John came on board, and it was fraught with difficulties. I went to FBI headquarters in Washington, explained what we were going to do, and was kind of given a pat on the head and 10 FBI wanted posters and told to go break a leg.
Yeah, exactly. or have your legs broken?
One of the two. And at the time, the show was actually, show premiered only on the 7 Fox-owned and operated television stations. It was kind of its road show tour before going wide on the network. So I sat there at my desk looking at these 10 wanted posters and trying to figure which of these fugitives is hiding in one of the 7 Fox-owned markets. Otherwise, we're never going to catch the guy.
Yeah, right.
And I picked a guy from Chicago, David James Roberts, who had murdered a family, burned down their home with them in it because of, after stealing $200 worth of tires from the man's tire store. And figured he was in Chicago. Little did I know that he was actually hiding on Staten Island in the shadow of our New York station, and that he would be captured within 4 days.
Wow.
And with a capture of one of the FBI's 10 most wanted on our premiere show in only 7 markets, it just caught fire. We had somehow, some way, captured lightning in a bottle.
How long was it from the time the show aired until he was captured?
The segment was actually shot on location in Indiana where the crimes took place 8 months before the show aired. And so there was this, you know, bullet in the gun just waiting to be fired on television.
Wow.
And reaching out and capturing this guy. And I'll tell you, one of the things that really impressed me most about the phenomenon was I was able to call the surviving members of the victim's family when the captured news came in, got them on the phone, they were in North Carolina, and I said simply, "We got him." And I heard an instantaneous breakdown on the other end of the phone. And it's the most incredible moment when you see years of fear, these people were in hiding, when suddenly there is closure in a heartbeat, and it made such a difference in victims' lives. From that point on, any fugitive hunting request that we got from ordinary people got top drawer treatment at America's Most Wanted.
Yeah, I can imagine that. You know, back then, were things a little different than they are now? You know, obviously today in the news, we're all dealing with this, issue of the citizens versus the police. And you know, with Colin Kaepernick talking, bringing it into the limelight with his protests and wearing socks with pigs on them. How was it during your tenure at America's Most Wanted dealing with the police? And was there this friction, and was there racial problems, or were you able to overcome any issues that existed?
There was more of a suspicion about police, and as I look back on it today, I suspect this is a cyclical thing. But police told me, many of them from all branches of law enforcement, that this show created a new relationship between law enforcement and the American public, and it ended a suspicion hangover from the anti-establishment 60s when cops were considered pigs. And many in law enforcement credited the show with creating a working partnership with the public. It became, in essence, the nation's biggest neighborhood watch association. And now we seem to have come full circle. It wasn't so much a racial thing back then, but it was simply nobody really knew whether they could trust the police or whether some tip might lead a bunch of police to their door and linkage to the crime. It's one reason that we set up our phone banks at the show, a working set, took in 5,000 phone calls a week to insulate people from the police. They could tell us, we would tell the police, and generally not release. We could tell people that, you know, their information could be held in strict confidence.
Yeah. So when you look back, what do you think about the most powerful stories that you did? Or is there something that stands out, or someone with respect to, and I know there's just so many when you go through all the years, but is there anything that stands out in your mind with respect to one particular fugitive or one particular story?
Out of 1,202 captures, one does stick out, and that was John List, who had murdered his wife, his mother, and two of his children and laid their bodies out in the grand ballroom of a house that he couldn't afford to furnish, took precautions, meticulous precautions, the kind that only an accountant would take, and vanished for 18 years. One of the things Liszt did before he took off was to destroy every known photograph of himself. And this case had been pitched to us by law enforcement over and over and over again. But the secret, of course, was having a current photograph of the fugitive that we could display. And we had none. We had an 18-year-old photograph, one, that we had found. So I found a forensic sculptor in Baltimore, the kinds of guys who can take clay, apply it to a skull, and recreate facial features. And I asked him to age this fugitive. He examined the man's diet, the fact that his eyesight may be failing, so he was probably wearing glasses, put together a bust of what he believed John Liszt would look like. We put that bust on a turntable and rotated it before the camera, and after 18 years, captured this guy. It was an absolutely remarkable story.
That is amazing. That is a great story. It sounds like a movie of the week or something, and I know that this was...
Well, it was made into a movie of the week, and here is the... Here is the kicker. When Judgment Day, the movie was made,
right,
in a wonderful piece of irony, Robert Blake was cast as John Liszt.
Isn't that a piece of irony? A fugitive in his own right.
Indeed.
So we're going to take a break in a couple minutes, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about John Walsh. Obviously,
sure,
the show is no longer on the air. And John did so much great work in finding people who had done horrible, heinous things. But then there were some controversies that came out. I think when he was on the Larry King Live show, he talked about his struggles with sex addiction. And he said stuff like, never have a male babysitter. So he went out into the public, and here he was on the America's Most Wanted, being this, you know, good guy on a white knight. And then you look at his life, and maybe there were certain things that weren't always going right or were perfect. How did that play out on the show?
It was fairly transparent. Let me put it this way. As far as the viewers were concerned, it was totally opaque. It just goes to prove that if you take a close look at any of our heroes, you'll find that there may be clay feet. None of us is perfect. And John, of course, had been living under incredible tension. When you walk around and you spend your entire life reliving the abduction and death of your son as the father of a murdered child, I can only imagine how that fueled the man. And it created in him a great degree of tension and a great degree of need to resolve that horrible event that had happened in his life. And I think that, you know, a couple of things. That got the better of him. I think also becoming a national celebrity, which a lot of people are not able to handle, you know.
Right.
And I think, to his credit, the fact that he did go public, the fact that he essentially cleared the air, not only saved John Walsh from himself, but it made America care about this guy even more. How many of us could deal with the kind of life that he did? Can talk to parents of murdered kids for years and years and years and relive that story, retell that story. It's the kind of story that doesn't get old,
right?
Not in the consciousness of a man like John Walsh.
Yeah, that's true. All right. This, you know, it's really interesting talking about this because there's so many underpinnings of America's Most Wanted. We're talking to Michael Linder. When we come back, we're going to talk to Scott Gariola, FBI special agent and a member of the L.A. Area Fugitive Task Force. Stay with us. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Have you or
or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Hey, this is Randy Miller with the National Defense, and we have the most patriotic show on the radio. Every Sunday night at 9, we talk to our active duty military, veterans, and their families, and we investigate resources and companies involved in making their lives better. This week, we'll talk to the director of the Navy SEAL Foundation and find out how PenFed Credit could give you some free money. That's this Sunday night at 9, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yo, E, give me some of that damn fried chicken.
KFC has created a Kentucky Fried Chicken SPF 30 sunscreen.
Oh, God. Does it smell like chicken?
Yes, it does.
Ew! Are you kidding me? Get over here. You smell so good. I want to eat you. is that the turkey cookie? No, your mom's just sunbathing out there. She forgot to put the bird in. But that's her. She smells like fried chicken.
The Drive Home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips.
Weekdays 3 to 6.
On Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Kerry Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, and we are back. I am Alan Gervey, and this is Gervey's Law. We're talking today about finding bad guys looking for fugitives. The FBI's top 10 list, and of course, in the last half hour, we had a fascinating conversation with Michael Linder, who is the original executive producer and creator of America's Most Wanted, a show that aired for many, many years. Michael, how many years did the show America's Most Wanted air?
23 years on Fox, and then it found a Lifetime on Lifetime channel from 2011 to 2012. And, of course, these days it continues to exist in a form as The Hunt with John Walsh on CNN.
And you said it was 23 years. Coincidentally, yeah. It is said that Whitey Bulger was featured on America's Most Wanted 23 times. And apparently the show didn't really succeed with Whitey Bulger, but someone did, and that was Scott Gariola, amongst others, of course, who's an FBI special agent and a member of an L.A. area fugitive task force who actually apprehended the Boston crime boss and is known as one of the top FBI agents, probably dealing with more top 10 most wanted cases than anyone else in FBI history. Scott, welcome to Gervey's Law.
You've got me. I'm here.
You are here. And you know, first of all, I got to congratulate you for all of this great work. We've been talking to Michael Linder, and the two of you, amongst other people, have provided so much of safe feeling for people, because this is something some of these criminals, notorious criminals, it's just really scary out there, and you are protecting the citizens, and you don't get enough credit, especially in this day and age where we have people who are bad-mouthing cops and not really singing the praises of people like you. Tell us about Whitey Bulger and how you were finally able to apprehend him just a few years ago in Santa Monica.
Right, Alan. Well, you know, I happened to be at the right place. And I like to say the wrong time because I was on vacation that week, but it turned out to be the right time and the right place. And, you know, I'd covered leads on that matter over the years. I've been doing fugitives for 20 years. I've been in the Bureau for over 28. So in the past 20 years, I'd covered a lot of leads. But on that day, when I received the call from the Boston office, it was a little bit different. It sounded the lead sounded better, and there was something in it that prompted me to leave home that day and go into work and call my LAPD guys and task force officers and gather in Santa Monica. So it was pretty much handed to me, and it was just using some ingenuity and some creativity and trying to get him out and confirm that he was in there, so we wouldn't burn the location. Without knowing if he was actually inside or not. So that's, you know, I can take credit for that part along with the LAPD. But, you know, the information we received was spot on from Boston. And we did what we do every day.
And did they use his girlfriend to get to him? Is that sometimes when someone is slippery, you have to go to people who they may deal with on an ongoing basis? Is that what happened in Whitey's case?
Sure. That was. They tried a new technique where focusing on Catherine rather than putting the same old tired photos of him out there. They tried, they obtained some new photographs of Catherine from some plastic surgery she had before she went on the run. And they put those out, and they focused the public service announcement. They focused on her and those photographs. And I think it was a combination of, you know, matching him with her in those new photographs that actually led to the tip.
Now, Michael, you had Whitey featured on America's Most Wanted quite a few times. Was there something that you felt you had done to help with apprehending him throughout the period of time, or was it just completely lost, and was there no way to find him during the television broadcast?
Well, we really didn't consider that we made much of a difference until the guy was captured. And
isn't that always the way?
The FBI did a formidable job in bringing this guy in. But that's the thing about the FBI. I was talking about the John List case. That was pursued for 18 years by every new agent who joined the New York or New Jersey branch of the FBI was assigned the John List case. They just did not sleep. They did not quit. And when you've got that in a federal law enforcement agency, it's a recipe for success.
And Scott, you mentioned that Catherine changed her looks, and this is something that you're dealing with all the time. How are you to find these fugitives when they're doing things like even trying to change their fingerprints to escape law enforcement?
Well, it's, you know, without giving away, you know, how we do it, it's just being persistent. Like Michael was saying, I mean, when every new agent comes in, they may get some of these old cases, and it's their responsibility to try and freshen them up. Persistence is the key. Sometimes you have to let a case sit for a while, give the fugitive a chance to settle down and maybe be more relaxed than he normally is. But then after a while, it's just you have to maintain contacts with the people in his, you know, circle of friends or family and keep on them, because that's invariably, that's who they go back to.
And a lot of times they're fleeing, so they may be found in Mexico, Central America. Tell us about Henry Solis and how you were able to bring him to justice.
Well, that was a combination of, you know, in these cases, reward plays a big role. You know, in the Bulger case, there was a $2 million reward on his head, $100,000 on Catherine. Solis, we put a $25,000 reward out for his arrest. And that, along with the publicity from the media, from the print media, all the stations that covered it, and then the great work done by the Mexican police in our office in El Paso, and it's the liaison, the cross-border liaison, the international liaison, the FBI is fantastic at. We've been doing it for, you know, almost 100 years with these international offices and operations overseas. We have 70 offices overseas. I mean, you just can't replace that. The human intelligence and the human relationships that are built between the FBI and our international partners, combined with the reward and the persistence that the agents in El Paso and the diligence from the agents and detectives here. And, you know, we're nothing without these great work of the homicide detectives from LAPD and other departments in our area. They're the ones that give us the work. They, without them solving the cases and getting these fugitives identified, you know, we're nothing to do.
So when we talk about someone like Solis, why don't you tell us a little bit about what he did and why you were after him? Because in this case, does it have kind of a special meaning? When we talk about cops having a bad name in certain circumstances, which we're dealing with in today's world all too frequently, do you have any more motivation to get someone like Solis?
Well, first off, let me just say that Henry Solis is an ongoing matter. It's in the midst of the prosecution. So I can't comment too much on that other than what was already put out there. And it was alleged that he had a fight with a person outside of a nightclub in Pomona, and he murdered that person. And Pomona obtained a warrant for his arrest, and that's where we stepped in. So other than that, and, you know, our capture, is not much I really can comment on that. Now,
But he did identify himself as an LAPD officer, didn't he? Allegedly.
I'm not aware of that. I never had any information that happened or occurred at that moment during the incident. So that's news to me.
Okay. Well, I'm just reading it. So, you know, what do I know? I'm just a lawyer. I just put out, arguments and evidence. Half the time they don't hold water.
But I mean, to answer your second part of the question, I mean, I obviously I'm not in a vacuum here. I see what's going on. I mean, we experience some of the problems dealing with the public. And then we also, the other side of that is we also get acknowledgement from the good work that we do from citizens. Just the other day, I was in Anaheim, and this woman, you know, I was talking to, she says, you know what, I respect everybody in blue, what you guys do every day. So that kind of counterbalances the bad that's out there, and you know, it's part of the job. That's, you know, it's what we signed up for, and you know, I don't expect it to be a bed of roses out there.
I think it's interesting you say that, because with all of the attention that has been given recently about the police, especially because of the NFL and started with Colin Kaepernick, I think people are realizing that, and perhaps there are more supporters than you had before, because people do realize all the good you do. With respect to what America's Most Wanted did on its show, Michael, did you find people saying to you, thank you, we appreciate it, obviously especially the victims' families, but isn't it true that people do recognize the good that you did on that show?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as Scott was saying, it's a partnership. And we dealt with virtually every law enforcement jurisdiction in the country. And echoing what he said, to have those kinds of resources, you know, was the thing. John Walsh got a lot of this because he was simply recognizable by everybody in America. And people had no hesitation, you know, in praising the man to his face and thanking him. It's good work that is being done, and for all the right reasons. And some people make TV shows because they make money. Other people, you know, are able to imbue them with a certain meaning and a certain mission. And people recognize that mission, whether it's a television show doing it, whether it's the FBI or the marshals, alcohol and firearms, you name it. That mission that counts.
Let's hope that people recognize it, because unfortunately in this world, not all people recognize the mission, and there are a lot of people, though, and I think they get lost. The great majority do. We have one more segment. We're talking to Scott Gariolo, FBI special agent, and Michael Linder, executive producer of America's Most Wanted. We're talking about finding fugitives. We're going to talk about the FBI's top 10 list after this break. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervais and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervais and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RJW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RJW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
People are always talking about the stock market. Always looking to invest in a good opportunity. Something with the potential to grow. So what if you could invest in the future? The future of kids. Like a stock. Not the kind of stock where you invest to make money, but a stock for a social change. A whole new kind of investment called Better Futures. When you invest, it helps students like me go to college, which ends up making the future better for everybody. I could be the first college graduate in my family, the first district attorney from my neighborhood. And if I'm the first, then maybe there will be a second and a third. This can really be the start of something. My name is Charles, and I'm your dividend.
Invest in better futures with UNCF. Visit uncf.org/invest. A mind is a terrible thing to waste, but a wonderful thing to invest in. A public service announcement brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Hey, what's going on?
Coming up on the next Drive Home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips, it's House of Cards meets WrestleMania as Hillary and Donald debate for the first time.
I want to know who's going to end up bloody, who's going to end up crying, and who's going to end up rolled up in a ball in the corner.
I want to see my mama.
Well, I'm going to the debate, so probably me. Live and local, right after Dr. Drew and Mike Catherwood, right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We're talking about finding bad guys today, and we have with us Scott Gariola, FBI special agent and member of LA Area Fugitive Task Force. He is known for handling a number of top 10 most wanted cases, including Whitey Bulger. Now, Scott, let me ask you this. How does the top 10 list get established, and how do you get assigned cases from them?
Sure. Well, you know, the top 10 list has been established for years since Hoover was a director. And the criteria that we use and that I always go by and our headquarters uses for selection is that the person or persons that they need to put on the top 10 list, it needs to be some kind of significant crime, usually a crime of violence, something significant, and that most of the normal or the routine investigative leads have been exhausted. It would be we need to show that, and then also that the publicity, we believe the publicity will aid to the arrest or capture. And what comes along with placement on a top 10 list is a $100,000 reward. And so I think when they assess the candidates for the 10 most wanted list, and I've placed three on a 10 most wanted list, that's what you're trying to argue for, that you know, it's a significant crime. It's important to our community here for, you know, these reasons. I mean, I put a guy, Emigdio Preciado, he shot at sheriff's deputies during a traffic stop in 1998 in Whittier. You know, he took off, and, you know, is he a continuing threat to the community? Yeah, I mean, you have to argue that he is, because he had no regard for law enforcement or safety of others. Pops out of a van and fires 20-something rounds from an AK. So that's the criteria. It's ongoing, continuing threat to the community. We've exhausted our leads. The publicity and the reward are going to aid in his capture.
What about Jose Luis Sainz? Is he also one of your top 10 guys?
He's another one. He was responsible for at least four murders here in Los Angeles, three in 1998. Two of those were in the city, one was in the county, and then he came back in 2008 and is alleged to have killed someone else. That's another ongoing case here in Los Angeles.
When you say ongoing, what does that mean?
I mean, the status is prosecution. He hasn't been prosecuted yet.
But you did apprehend him.
Yeah, I apprehended him. I had him apprehended in Mexico. I was down there for a couple of weeks, and we caught him in Guadalajara.
Sounds like you've got a lot of great vacations on with your job.
I don't know if you consider it a vacation when you're working every day, but yeah, I've been to some interesting places around the world in pursuit of fugitives, that's for sure.
Michael Linder, the executive producer and creator of America's Most Wanted, tell us if you think things have changed since you started with the fugitives, finding fugitives, searching for them. And with the show, have things changed with the technology changes, with the internet? Is it easier or harder to find these bad guys now?
To a certain degree, it is harder. The Hunt with John Walsh, it's a great show, though its effectiveness doesn't compare because the critical mass of viewers that America's Most Wanted had in the days of four networks, when one out of four U.S. homes were watching that show on any given Sunday night, you were able to speak to the nation. In three seasons, The Hunt has led to seven captures and two surrenders, and America's Most Wanted scored that many in a single week in 1988. So the fact that you've got an explosion of media, which has impacted TV shows, newspapers, radio stations, everybody, has made it more difficult. Yes, there are more photos of 10 most wanted fugitives out there, but there isn't the central nexus, the central marketplace where you can go and really take part in the hunt for these guys.
Scott, would you agree with that?
Well, you know, what I would add, you know, social media and the internet has obviously made it a lot easier for people to hide. But the other side of that is we use it in law enforcement all the time to getting photos out. We do. We have the FBI.gov website, which reaches millions of people. We do Facebook blasts on fugitives in you know, foreign countries. So, you know, there's definitely an advantage to have everybody on social media and using phones for publicity's sake. And also, you know, it's easier sometimes in some respects to find people when they're glued to that type of device. So, I mean, it's definitely, it's a double-edged sword as far as I'm concerned.
Now, do you think because...
Well, Alan, if I may bring up one point. The technology has enabled certain things, such as mining that great internet, using facial recognition photography in looking for fugitives, the ability to harvest silos of data and build case files on them by tracking down
right.
Known relatives, high school friends, Facebook pals, all that kind of thing.
So we're running out of time. Sorry, Michael. Go ahead. Finish up.
No, I'm done.
Okay. Well, don't say it so quickly. You're not done. not with me yet. Scott, just in about 30 seconds, what Michael talks about with the technology, is it more challenging now because fugitives also have technology and they can avoid capture by doing things? Have you seen extreme measures taken to avoid capture?
Well, it definitely puts, you know, gives us a little more work to do. But like I said, it has also some benefits for that technology. We've experienced them and, you know, we utilize them. And I have to add before I let you go that, you know, I miss America's Most Wanted. It was fantastic. We use it all the time. I had a lot of captures with it. I wish there was one place viewers could go to see fugitives around the nation like we used to.
Well, that's some high praise, Michael.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Scott. Yes.
So before we leave in 10 seconds, tell us, what can we do? And I know this isn't a 10-second question or an answer. What do you see in the future? How can we make things easier for you? Michael?
Well, as the show slogan said, you can make a difference. And with 1,202 captures, America's Most Wanted did. Just keep in mind the new slogan. If you see something, say something. Be involved.
Scott?
Well, I'm going to piggyback on that and say anonymity. We can offer that. We offer rewards. And if you know somebody who's wanted, 888-CAN'T-HIDE. Give us a call.
888-CAN'T-HIDE. What a great way to end the show. Scott Gariola, FBI Special Agent, thank you so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law. And Michael Linder from America's Most Wanted, thank you for being here. Right here.
Thanks, Alan.
Well, Garrett, we're going to go out and catch some bad guys now. Thanks for listening to Gervie's Law. We got a lot of work to do, folks. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you. This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.